Blog Talk.
Hello, this is Debbie Guy-Gieche of the Pedowitz Group, and welcome to WRMR, Revenue Marketer Radio. As you guys know, we meet every Thursday to talk to a real revenue marketer and learn tips and tricks on how to make that transition from traditional marketing to real revenue marketing. And as we talk about the topic of revenue marketer, let me just give you guys a brief definition, because a revenue marketer is something very unique in the world of marketing today. A revenue marketer is someone on the team who has revenue or revenue-related accountability through the kinds of campaigns, communications, and digital interactions they set up. They are responsible for the top of the sales funnel and for interacting with and nurturing leads until they are sales ready. And they all use some type of marketing automation platform that is integrated with CRM to power their revenue marketing practice and to get those revenue results. So today we have a very special guest. I was able to hear Evan speak, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, at an event that we attended. And I said, this guy, we have to have him on the radio show. When I was talking to Evan about what we would talk about, I said, you know, Evan, I said, when I heard you speak, I said, you sounded just like a VP of sales, but you're the director of demand generation. So I said, let's kind of focus on that as our topic today. And so let me give you Evan's background, and then we're going to get into talking to Evan White Knight of ReachForce. Now, Evan is currently the director of marketing at ReachForce, which is an Austin-based SaaS provider of contact data services. He has more than 10 years in sales and marketing, and he's held strategic marketing positions at NeverFail, Pervasive Software, Vignette, and Dell Computer. Prior to joining ReachForce, he held the position of director of marketing at NeverFail, where he was responsible for the go-to-market strategy for both the NeverFail product line and the strategic marketing alliances with partners such as Microsoft, Research in Motion, and VMware. He holds a Master's of Business Administration with a focus in marketing, I think that is so cool, and e-commerce from St. Edward's University, and a Bachelor's of Science degree in chemistry. I didn't know that, Evan, and that explains your approach to things from the University of Texas. I get it now. I'm beginning to get it. And okay. He also has extensive experience in CRM and marketing automation platforms. So, Evan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Debbie. I appreciate being a guest of the show.
So I got to tell everybody a funny story that's listening. So when Evan and I were doing our pre-brief, I talked to 15 or 20 minutes to the folks before they come on the show. I said, Evan, you and I both have the same problem. I said, we both have Southern accents and we talk real fast. So and the combination of us two together, it'll probably sound like really fast. So we'll try to try to slow down so we can articulate for everybody. But, Evan, why don't we start by telling me a little bit more besides your director of marketing at ReachForce, kind of what your role is at ReachForce.
Sure, definitely, Debbie. My role here at ReachForce is, like you said, director of marketing, but it's really to kind of head up everything marketing and sales related. So, you know, we're a marketing services firm such as yourself. We provide high-quality lead data services that enable businesses to grow their revenue impact and demand creation initiatives by 100%. So we, you know, live and breathe marketing every day. So my role here is not only to drive demand generation and demand creation, but it's really to kind of be, I'd say, a cheerleader, a champion, someone who understands and can train our sales force on how to sell to marketers and how to really understand what B2B marketers are all about and what they're doing. So, you know, every day here is a different story. One day it could be doing a webinar and doing a presentation. The next day is putting together a nurture campaign. The next day is kind of being what we call a sales ranger, getting on the phone, helping our salespeople figure out what marketers' pains are and how best to solve them in terms of data cleanliness and data quality for their marketing campaigns. So that kind of encompasses kind of a day in the life of what I do around here.
So I got to tell you, the other day when I called you and, we were talking about the show, and I said, Evan, I said, you sound just like a VP of sales. And you said, Debbie, that's funny because I'm actually in CRM right now. And tell us what you were doing.
Yeah, every day I've got Salesforce CRM open. I've got two monitors for my system. One monitor is dedicated to Salesforce, and I've got my dashboard up. And, as you can see kind of from my bio, my background is in chemistry. So for me, it's everything's got to be quantifiable, kind of measured-based. So, I always try to put hypotheses around things and then test them and measure the data. So, you know, one thing about being in the position and role I'm in at this organization is, and also being a Salesforce certified admin, is I live and eat and breathe in the dashboard. So I've put together an overall corporate dashboard for the rest of the executive team here at ReachForce to really take a look at. And we've maxed it out with 20 components. We're already working on our second dashboard. So we can constantly see where the funnel lies, where deals are, if they're getting stuck, how many leads are in the open stage. I can see where the leads are in the qualification status, going from inquiry to marketing qualified to sales accepted to sales qualified. We track things like conversion percentages through the stages, conversion percentages to proposals delivered, close won, close loss analysis is something that I actually run on a weekly and monthly basis, and then we also do a quarterly review of where we were at and kind of where the team was quarter to quarter. So it's something that I live, eat, and breathe, and like I had told you, you know, it is kind of like a VP of sales. I could be anywhere at any time, and I think, you know, a few weeks ago when I met you, I was sitting there talking to you, and you could say, yeah, I can tell you where each of my reps are as far as quota attainment goes, probably down to the dollar, if not the penny, and also tell you, you know, what the pipeline looks like, where everything is in the stage format. And I couldn't go as far as deep dive as my VP of sales, but I'm pretty close on any given day.
So that's a ton of information for somebody to digest in one sitting. So what I want to do is I want to back up. And I want to kind of tease this apart a little, one piece at a time, so that we can share not just your excitement, but some real practical tips and approaches for our listeners, because our listeners are at every different range. It could be a beginner, they could be advanced like you, but let's just kind of tease this thing apart. And what I want to go back to is, I know that you guys use Marketo, right?
Yeah, we actually have Marketo and Eloqua in-house. Since we're a partner of both, we have both in-house. We use both marketing automation systems because we like to be able to speak as an expert to our end-user customers. And so, you know, we have both in-house so we can test both systems, understand both systems, and fully speak to both systems.
Now, that is unique. So for your own marketing purposes, which application do you use, or use a combination of both?
I actually use a combination of the both. So I use Marketo for a lot of our lead nurture and lead campaigns as far as tracking new inquiries and things of that nature. We use Eloqua more for our installed base and customer newsletter sorts of things. So we use both systems to kind of segment our list and take a different approach, and it also keeps us kind of versed in both of the different platforms so that if a question arises with a customer of how to best manipulate or do some things with data cleanliness and data quality in their systems, we can speak to both systems very in-depth.
Okay, I want to go back in time, and I want you to because clearly you just didn't all of a sudden one day wake up and bam, you're at this place where you can talk about the discrete concrete impact that marketing is making on revenue. So let's kind of go back to how that journey started for you, and clearly being a partner of both Eloqua and Marketo, and also using those applications for your own demand generation efforts is unique. But why don't we go back to the beginning and let's talk about, you know, how did you begin this journey toward revenue marketing?
Sure. And like you said, Debbie, it wasn't something that happened overnight, and by no means will it, I think, happen overnight for any marketer whatsoever. I think you've definitely got to take off bite-sized chunks and have small goals to get there on the road to get there. But, I mean, the way it happened was about 4 or 5 years ago, I was actually over at Pervasive Software, and we were really looking at, well, at that time we were a partner of Eloqua as well, and so we were developing the first kind of integration for Eloqua into Salesforce CRM, and so that's kind of where I got my chops and really looking at how does data integrate into from a CRM system to a marketing automation system, what kind of analytics can we get out of it. So it was really a lot of just myself kind of, I guess, having the passion and the desire to want to understand more from a scientific standpoint rather than a kind of qualitative standpoint from a marketing perspective. So just really digging in and understanding the tools, and if there are things that I couldn't myself understand, I wasn't afraid to ask questions. You know, I wasn't afraid to go to product specialists or other people in the organization to reach out and you know, have a brown bag lunch, have a discussion, and just have them kind of bring me up to speed and verse me on the different technologies that we had. I definitely wasn't a Salesforce admin in day one. There were times I couldn't even run my own reports. So it's just a matter of finding those people who have that knowledge in the organization and really fostering relationships, sitting down with them, trying to do some knowledge transfer, and then doing some kind of homework on my end of getting myself up to speed so I could, you know, kind of really be self-sufficient and really understand what I need to look for and where I need to look for these items.
So are you talking about before you guys began using the systems, or once you began using the systems, this going out and finding out more about, was it just kind of understanding what marketing automation
sure.
could do for you as an organization?
No, we were a marketing automation customer at that time. So, and even now, you know, still learning. So it's all about having the marketing automation system in place and just, you know, having that passion and desire to learn more, I guess. You know, all the systems have great self-paced training. I think I've learned a lot of the stuff I've learned about Marketo and Eloqua all through, you know, Eloqua University, and Marketo's got their customer.success.marketo, I think, platform where you can go and get a lot of self-paced training. And that's really where I spent a lot of the time first getting into the system and getting versed and getting to understand the platform and its abilities and where it could take me.
So let's talk about the metrics journey. So when you first began to engage with these platforms, what kind of metrics were you measuring in the early days? And I want to talk about the progression to what I call revenue marketing metrics. And to me, the difference is that companies transition from traditional marketing to what I call lead generation. And lead generation is typically characterized by, you know, having some kind of email system. And it's really the first generation of marketing supplying leads over to sales. And then I think the next phase is really demand generation, and that's when a company intakes a marketing automation system. And the difference between demand generation and the final ultimate phase of revenue marketing is that once you get into revenue marketing, the revenue that you contribute to the organization is repeatable, predictable, and sustainable. And clearly that's exactly where you guys are at. So let's talk about what your beginning metrics were, and what was your process for getting to metrics that matter and for getting to that sustainability and that predictability.
Sure. I think you hit the nail on the head. For us, when we first started, probably like any other marketer, when we first got the system, or I first got versed with marketing automation, it was all around tracking inquiries, really, and then tracking click-through rates and open rates. So it was all around just taking a look at a one-off email blast and saying, hey, that was cool. We sent that out. We had the ability to send it out on our own. We didn't need help from IT. And, oh, check it out. Look what happened. We had so and so many people open. You know, we had a 15% open rate, and then we had a 10% click-through rate. It was really cool. We could see these things on the fly. We could see what people were doing. And so that, in the beginning, was kind of what we were measuring, what we were kind of basing our success on, was how much of the word is getting out, how much are people taking action on. And then from there, it's really morphed and migrated, like you said, through the demand generation cycle all the way to the revenue generation cycle. So, in the middle, it was all around, okay, how many people can we actually make a marketing-qualified lead? Once we get to a marketing-qualified lead, we're kind of hands-off from there. We'll measure ourselves based upon there, and we'll pass those over from inquiry status over to the sales organization, and that's really what we'll base our success on. And I think for us, we started to see a lot of fall down there. There just wasn't a whole lot of sales and marketing alignment. We had some issues with SLAs not being followed up with. We had issues with sales complaining that, you know, we thought our leads were great, but they were thinking our leads weren't where they needed to be because the acceptance rate wasn't where it needed to be. So that's really what drove our need kind of down the lead generation funnel to the revenue generation part of the thing, is we wanted to get more tightly aligned with sales and marketing and figure out how we could do so. So then we started to take a look and say, okay, let's look at some best practices. Let's look where we can find some deep depth understanding of what we need to be doing, and that's when we became kind of a serious decisions partner and a customer and looking at some of their research and really looking at the demand generation to revenue generation funnel, and really began measuring ourselves not on MQLs and how many leads we were passing over the fence, but really taking a look at how many of those MQLs were actually turning into sales accepted leads, how many of those sales accepted leads were actually turning into sales qualified leads. So now we're measured from the rest of the executive team and to the board on how many sales accepted leads we pass over, i.e. how many meetings they take, and how many of those are actually converting and creating into actual revenue pipeline in the Salesforce CRM platform. So we're measured on sales accepted leads, sales qualified qualified leads, and then we're also being measured further down the funnel. So it doesn't just stop there for us. You know, we've taken it so far as looking at from sales qualified all through the different stages of qualification that we have, all the way through to proposal and then to close won and close lost. And we take a look at those different stage transactions and those different stage kind of conversion metrics and see where deals are getting stuck, where we as marketing can help sales out. You know, maybe it's a late stage campaign that's going to help somebody convert and take a meaningful demo to get them stuck out of a stage and get them moving through the funnel, or maybe it's a piece of collateral we can pass on that really helps them understand the product in the late stage buying cycle.
Okay. So, Evan, again, great high-level overview. I mean, you talked about once you got marketing automation, you know, in the early days, you guys were all about those efficiency and cool metrics, which was the ability to see inquiries, click-through, open rate, and you could send these campaigns out with no help from IT. And it was very cool to see how things happened in real time and kind of see things on the fly. And the fact that it was great just that you were getting the word out. And then it began from, okay, this campaign focused really more to what are our campaigns producing, which should be marketing qualified leads. So that was kind of like a phase two for you guys. And when you began to engage in that phase, you really, this is kind of where things weren't quite right. The sales and marketing alignment was not tight enough. So you thought you had great leads and sales wouldn't follow up, and, you know, it's the typical kinds of things. How long did it take you guys to move from, like, that inquiry stage to that MQL stage? How much time passed, do you think, between those two stages?
I'd say probably 2 quarters, a good 6 months of understanding, you know, really what the business is, what the business needed, and where we needed to take things. I think, you know, in the beginning, like you said, we were kind of in the inquiry to MQL stage. You know, we were having costly telemarketing costs to get things from MQL to sales accepted and sales qualified. Thusly, our cost of sale was almost 1.5 times what it is today. Like I had mentioned, there was a lack of marketing and sales alignment and an overall lack of follow-up and accountability. You know, sales just wasn't believing in what marketing was doing, and therefore the follow-up and the accountability was just not there as it needed to be.
Okay, so let's go into the MQL. So I got the inquiry. It took about 2 quarters to kind of realize it's really more about the output of the campaign. And I think that's a common thing. And the thing that I always like to tell people who are on this journey from traditional marketing to revenue marketing, wherever they are in that path, is it takes about 2 quarters just to watch things, right? Now, companies don't like to hear that, but, you know, to really get a handle on what you're doing, so that you can't get quick wins, you can get very quick wins, but to really understand what's going on and how these digital conversations are starting and how your base is responding to this type of communications, I think watching it for 2 quarters, I think that's probably about a best practice. And then once you guys began to move into the, okay, MQLs to sales, and so what did you do once you began? How long did it take you to move from kind of like that MQL to best practices, and give us some more succinct tactics that you guys use to kind of get sales on board and to get this joint accountability for revenue.
Sure, not a problem. So, you know, it took us maybe another, once we had that kind of the engine driving, it took us maybe another 4 to 6 weeks to get everything ginning as far as going from MQL to sales accepted and kind of really tightening the sales and marketing alignment. And some of the things we did specifically was actually built, you know, nothing fancy, actually nothing in Salesforce even, it's just some Salesforce reporting, but I built an Excel dashboard that really showed tactic by tactic where we were as far as inquiries to MQLs, to sales accepted leads, to close one, so that we could really get a micro focus based upon kind of our segmentation of what we were doing as versus driving net new business and current customer business or cross-sell, upsell. So really from that, we were able to really tighten our outgoing campaigns to message what we were trying to accomplish and also track the effectiveness of those campaigns in real time. And also we were able, from that dashboard, to really develop SLAs between the marketing and the sales department. So, you know, it's not just SLAs on the sales team, it's SLAs on the marketing team. So when we come back from a lead show, we've got an SLA on us to actually get the data back from the show, get it through our data cleanse kind of standardization process where we have all of our fields neat and appended and all the data is pretty and standardized to our format. So we've actually got an SLA there. And then we've got to get the data in-house. get marketing to it and get the lead scoring and lead nurturing going before we can even flip it over to sales. So we've got our SLAs there, and then once, you know, we're pushing things further down the funnel, but they need to qualify on a lead score basis before we hand them over to the sales department. And in order to do that, when we actually do flip them over, we've got SLAs in place that say, okay, once you get a lead or you've got a web-bound, inbound lead, you've got 24 hours to follow up with this before we start having some tracking emails go out that say some of these leads are starting to become stale.
So is this SLA a physical document?
It's actually not a physical document. It probably needs to be, but what it arose out of is just the, you know, my VP of sales and myself just sitting down one afternoon and saying, okay, here's, and this is also another thing, I guess, that came out of it is for us to get tighter integration, the two of us just really needed to sit down and define from sales and marketing what a lead is. So it started with the basic premise of here's what we define a lead, here's what we define our lead scoring to be. And it wasn't just marketing doing this. I had to get buy-in from senior sales as well of what a lead is, what lead scoring is, what our lead score threshold should be before I hand it over to sales. And it's something that we actually meet on a monthly basis to define and redefine and kind of tweak that number to see how we're doing as far as handing things over to sales, where the quality is. So it wasn't a physical document. Like I said, it probably needs to be, but it's something that we're a small enough organization that we take the time to really examine this and keep an eye on it.
So let me ask you this. Did you, when you were in that inquiry stage, those first two quarters, did you think you needed to have that kind of conversation and you were just delaying it, or was it, did it kind of come as a surprise?
I think it goes back to one of the slides you showed at one of the events with the head in the sand. You know, I think that's really what it was, is just, you know, our heads were in the sand. We were kind of full bore trying to get marketing automation up and running, trying to get everything going, trying to help really drive revenue for the organization. And for us, it was, we were thinking, man, we're marketing. This is what we can do. So let's stick our head in the sand. We'll just do what we're going to do in our own isolated little world. And hopefully the organization as a whole will see a benefit from us doing one piece of what the business needs. Now, what we've seen,
Evan,
and what
I love,
learned.
Evan, I love your honesty, because
sure.
That's
yeah.
The exact reason I use that graphic, and it's the exact reason why I often challenge marketers. You need to get your head out of the sand. This stuff's not going away, and it's not exactly what you think it is.
Exactly, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's, you know, and you do have to kind of do a gut check at some point in time and say, okay, am I doing just what I need to do in order to keep, you know, marketing going and doing, you know, that from a basis? Or, you know, take a step back and really look at what is the end goal of marketing? The end goal of marketing is to drive inquiry and to drive, I guess, passion and understanding of your business all the way through to the sales funnel. So it's not just getting somebody on the hook and then letting it sit there and letting the salespeople reel them in. It's really fishing all the way through the life cycle, really nurturing a lead from A to Z all the way through.
So let me ask you this. Was there a tipping point? Not so much. Well, I want to say, was there a tipping point? Was it when you said to the VP of sales, we need to sit down and talk about this? Was that a real tipping point in the relationship?
Yeah, I think so. And the good thing is that he and I have worked together at previous organizations. So we started off with a close relationship and can talk to each other, which I think is a great thing. You know, there are days where we butt heads and we don't agree, and he needs things at an unrealistic time frame. And so we do have our odds and ends there. But I think, you know, we both kind of sat down and talked to each other and said, okay, this thing's working, but it could be working a lot better. We could have a lot more efficiencies out of this, and let's see what we could drive for the organization if we really put our heads together and really took a look at all the key metrics as far as, you know, leads coming through the pipeline, cost of sale, all the key metrics that impact what we do from marketing and sales organization all the way through to revenue recognition for the organization.
So that was a key tipping point with the VP of sales, and clearly having that alignment between marketing and sales is absolutely critical, or very few things will actually get done. Was there a tipping point with the sales organization when they finally realized the value that marketing could be contributing to revenue?
Yeah, I think so. You know, when we started really focusing not so much on MQLs and really driving sales accepted leads and helping them to set meetings and get people on the phone rather than flipping leads to them and having them do sort of some telemarketing and some warming of the leads and trying to reach out to these people multiple times in order to get a meeting, they started to see the real benefit of what we could deliver and what we could drive. And, you know, what we've been able to do is remove a role, reduce our cost of sale, so therefore there's less telemarketing. What we're doing as a marketing organization is actually pushing the leads further down the funnel via lead scoring and lead nurturing, and then popping them out further nurtured, further engaged, and more ready for the sales team to engage with. So when our sales team picks up the phone, the conversion of them actually getting them on the phone and getting a meeting set is very high. And then for going from sales accepted to sales qualified, we're tracking it like 75 to 80% right now as far as setting a meeting to getting real dollars in the pipeline from those meetings.
So let's go back and define a few things within the framework that you just described to us. And you're right. In my experience, nothing gets the attention of a salesperson quicker than saying, how can I help you meet quota? And then providing high-quality appointments and leads to them. So one of the things that you did was, of course, with lead nurturing and lead scoring, you really were getting people, finding people deeper into their buying process, almost ready to engage with someone. And at that point, did that lead then go to a telequalifier, or did it go straight over to sales?
It actually went straight over to sales. So we found that we could remove the telequalification point for us because it felt like to us, first of all, it was bumping up our cost of sale, and secondly, it was feeling that we were having two customer phone call engagements when we could actually really just have one. So that was able to help us. It just helped us create a greater velocity through the pipeline. You know, most of the time when, and especially as you may know, Debbie, selling to marketers, it's not the easiest thing in the world. They're extremely busy, and I think sometimes a lot, and I can say this myself too, my vendor management isn't what it needs to be. So as far as getting someone on the phone and talking to them and actually having a meaningful conversation the first time out was something that really helped us in our specific business case.
So I really like this model, and again, everyone does it differently, but if you can take lead nurturing and lead scoring and really do that in a rigorous process, track and watch that lead until they really are ready for a phone call, then I think that is significant. But I want to talk about the definitions that you use from Serious Decisions, because we're using terms NQL, SAL, and SQL. So can you kind of define for us what those mean at ReachForce?
Sure, definitely. So an MQL for us is a lead that has come in, so an inquiry. Someone had an inquiry into our business, or we had a discussion with them, or we ran across them at a trade show. And then what we do to make it an MQL here is we actually run it through our data cleanse and data quality process, our engine. And what that does is it allows us to append all the information that we need to have that be a full marketing qualified lead. So we have everything from email address, correct title, correct phone number, a lot of times direct dial phone numbers, all the way through to company information like company size, number of employees, what industry they're in based upon SIC code and NAICS code, so that we can actually use that to do some of our lead scoring. So we want to make sure all these people are in our wheelhouse before we even start putting them through the sales cycle. So we're looking at how large of an organization is, what's their revenue range, does it fit within our kind of sweet spot or market segmentation. Are they in the right industry? All these things are plus scores in our lead scoring campaigns and help to promote the lead further along. And if they're not the right things, we actually use a negative lead scoring campaign to demote them so that they're not being artificially presented to sales when they shouldn't be. So it's all about helping sales at our organization narrow in on who they need to be talking to and what's the best focus for them.
So an MQL, how do you go from MQL to SAL? And that's a sales accepted lead.
Yep, exactly. So from MQL to SAL, we've got a lot of lead nurture campaigns going on in the background. And, you know, another thing I spoke to, and I think you've spoken to this a million times too, is content is king. So for us, we're constantly writing content. It's myself and two other team members. So between that, I'll talk a little bit about our roles. So I'm kind of the overall watcher and kind of creator of the campaigns. I'm also, you know, definitely can get my hands dirty and get into Marketo and Salesforce and get all that stuff going. But then I've got kind of a marketing programs manager, or really kind of the marketing technologist, as I like to call it, is somebody who lives and breathes in Marketo and really understands that. And he's also someone who can live and breathe in data quality and data cleanliness, and is also a Salesforce admin. So he's kind of the technologist who really understands everything at a very micro level and can get in there. And then we've also got another person who's very good at copywriting and has more of a journalistic understanding of the B2B space and can really do a lot of writing for us, from content creation of our e-books to our blogs to case studies to everything else that we do. So we kind of round robin ourselves in areas of expertise so that we can create these campaigns and really nurture the leads through the life cycle and really take a look at each stage they are. So we have different campaigns that touch someone from the very beginning to the middle stage of really going from MQL to SAL. So we start off our lead scoring at zero. Our actual threshold's at 400. We go by 25-point increments just so they're picking up chunks. The reason I like to use bigger numbers rather than plus ones or plus twos is because when sales gets a lead that looks like 400, it looks a whole lot more impressive than a lead that comes over to them.
I got to tell you, that is a fabulous idea. I never thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it just allows us more functionality in our lead scoring to do negative scoring as well. So instead of doing negative one or negative two, if someone really comes in and they go to my careers page, I automatically hit them with a negative 100, so that it's a big kind of bullseye for sales to say, ooh, I'm looking in my Marketo Sales Insight dashboard. I don't want to touch these guys. They're actually looking at us for a career. They're not interested in buying anything from me.
I love that. So you do a number of things to get it from MQL to SAL, right? But I'm assuming that MQL has to have some kind of score, which is 400?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
Okay. So if the MQL, if it hits 400, it becomes, are you doing all these things and it's called an MQL, or does it become an MQL at 400?
No, it becomes an MQL when we get it fully appended and ready to go into the lead nurture system. It becomes
an
SAL when it becomes 400, when it reaches our lead score threshold.
Once it reaches
our lead score threshold, that's when the salespeople first pick up the phone and try to engage with these folks. And normally, more often than not, they can get them on the first or second call with them being ready to actually have a discussion with us. So it's cut down our number of call attempts to these folks. And with it going through our MQL process with our data cleanliness and quality campaign, you know, most of the time they have direct dials or they have the correct phone number to reach out to these folks, so it's really helped us cut down on call cycles.
Okay, and as everyone knows, ReachForce is an organization that does beautiful data hygiene, data append work, and so clearly in this case they are drinking their own champagne or eating their own dog food, you know, whichever it is, and as a result, one of the things that I do want to talk, and Evan and I are going to talk about, is the impact that data quality has on the effectiveness of being a revenue marketer, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But so as an MQL, and then it's you've got a data pinned, so it's complete. At 400, it becomes an SAL. And I'm assuming that once it reaches 400, there's a real-time notification that is sent to the sales owner, correct?
That is correct. We've got an alert system in Marketo that automatically sends out an alert saying that your lead has now met a threshold score of a sales accepted lead. And then we also, that's just one thing we do, then it also gets bubbled up to the Sales Insight Marketo integration into Salesforce so they can see it in their lead views. And they can sort by last interesting moment as well. So Marketo tracks last interesting moments so they can see, did they fill out a form? Did they visit a certain page that put them over the limit? Did they respond to one of our nurture campaigns? It gives them all this insight before they pick up the telephone. And they can actually really see in the marketing automation in the Marketo platform what marketing is done in a real-time basis and what all the collateral looks like in its true form, rather than speaking anecdotally to what marketing is doing. Sales can now speak as an expert and really understand what the prospect has seen through the cycle, rather than speaking, like I said, anecdotally to it.
And haven't you found evidence of this process? And this is an endlessly fascinating observation to me, in that when you start watching that online behavior and understanding it, both from a marketing and also from a sales perspective, that's one of those tipping points that really aligns sales and marketing, because sales is now seeing this online behavior means something, and that there is a tipping point and there is the right time to call someone based on what you observe in their online behavior.
That's correct. I think you're very astute in that comment, in the fact of that if you call someone too early, sometimes it can, I think, in my opinion, scare off a prospect. You come on too hot and heavy. It's kind of like a first date. People just you know, don't want to call you back sort of thing. So it's all about timing and engaging with the folks. And so we also, not only do we do lead nurturing, but we also have a heavy, large social media presence that we do as well, as far as Twitter, our blog, which is the B2B lead blog. We're also out on Facebook. So we're constantly hitting the social media channels as people are doing more peer-to-peer research, I believe, before looking to do or interact with a vendor. They're looking to turn to their peers and communities to try to understand what it is they're looking for and what it is the recommended solution at the time is. So, you know, we're trying to hit them early stage, we're trying to hit them middle stage, and we're trying to hit them late stage.
So I want to come back to the social, but I want to go back to, so what you do is you go inquiry to MQL, becomes an MQL mm-hmm. when the data is fully appended. You nurture that, watch the online activity. They hit a score of 400. It becomes a SAL, which stands for Sales Accepted Lead. You get a real-time alert over to the sales organization. It also shows up in their Sales Insight. It also probably populates in Salesforce.com. They pick up the phone and make a phone call. And if there are next steps, does it then at that point become an SQL?
That's correct. So if their next steps, okay. and they determine BANT there, so they're looking for budget, authority, need, and timing, they're marking all those in Salesforce. So in each of our stages in Salesforce for an opportunity, we've got different stages in Salesforce, and then we've also got custom fields within the opportunity object in Salesforce. So for each stage, we've got a different kind of drop-down section, if you will, in Salesforce. And
okay.
each section has a bunch of questions with check marks that our reps actually have to check to make sure that those things have been talked about and are there before they can advance it to the next stage.
Okay.
So that really goes into
opportunity?
When it becomes an opportunity.
Okay, perfect. All right. Let's talk about social, and then I definitely want to spend I want to spend some time talking about data as well, because I don't know what it is, but I tell you, this year seems to be the year of data. It's almost as if marketers are waking up and understanding the cost of bad data is too high a cost to pay. But let's talk about how you guys use social as part of your revenue marketing practice.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So a lot of our social, as I said, is to really drive the early stage buying. So the first initial kind of interaction we're going to have with the customer may not be a known interaction. We may not know who these folks are, but we're trying to get the word out there and kind of the understanding. And like you said, really drive, I think, a market segment that is really emerging. Data quality, data cleanliness, making sure you have the accurate and targeted lead data that you need to fuel your marketing automation platforms. It's really an emerging space that marketers are starting to pay attention to. And for us, it's a critical part of our business to get out there in the social media atmosphere and make sure that we're, you know, really a thought leader, because, you know, it's most days we've found prospects, when they come to our website and they're downloading our white papers, they've already evaluated vendors. They're just doing their final checks and gathering what they need to do to take a short list to management. Really, they're really doing a lot of their research peer-to-peer, and also in the social media space, looking at, you know, Twitter feedback, Twitter comments, blogs. And, you know, our blog is full of great information for folks. And it's not salesy at all. It's 100% focused at trying to help a marketer understand what it is that the marketing space is moving to, and how to best position themselves and kind of educate themselves to get there. So we're constantly doing, you know, top tips. We've got a great series on the blog, the Sales and Marketing Tips, and I think we're up to like number 325. So we've got constant tips and tricks and different things that are out there that we're constantly seeing from other spaces that we try to aggregate and make it an easy place for someone to come and get an education.
So is social for you guys mostly around getting the word out, understanding and providing thought leadership? Is there any direct revenue or any direct demand generation that you do as part of your social programs?
Yeah, we sure do. So we're constantly doing Twitter updates as far as everything we're doing, from a lead nurture campaign to driving people to webinars, driving people to new content that we've created. You know, we're also, I think the blog is one of our top referring sites to our website as far as driving people in. I think it's the top referral to our website to people to fill out contact us forms as far as ready to buy. So it's something that really helps get the word out, get the education out, and keeps people kind of in the conversation with us, and then when they're ready to buy, they turn to us because of that kind of thought leadership position. But it is a key role, albeit an early role, in our lead generation process.
And who writes your blog, Evan?
I actually write some of the blogs, but then most of the blogs are actually ghostwritten by members of my team. So we always take round robins, and we try to load up as many as we can because, like every other marketer, we're busy as all get out. So for us, we put a bunch of them up there in WordPress, and whatever the theme of the week happens to be is what we're kind of publishing through WordPress. So we try to stay ahead of the game there so that we have content there that we can always push out, and then we can kind of do what we need to do on a daily fire drill basis around here and kind of put out those fires rather than have to worry about getting all those loaded up every day. We kind of sit down sometimes on a Friday and say, okay, next week let's hit this topic. Let's everybody take two or three posts. And we try to stay between four and five posts a week, you know, almost one every day just to kind of keep that drumbeat going.
Now, is that 4 to 5 posts a day on your blog, I mean a week on your blog?
Yes, that's correct. So we try to do about 4 or 5 posts a week on the blog. We try to do at least – from the ReachForce Twitter handle and all the rest of our handles that we have here in the organization, we try to do anywhere from 20 to 30 tweets a day, depending on who's tweeting and what we're doing. So we're constantly trying to stay out there and keep in front of things and retweet and really look at who some of the influencers are in our area and how we can get in front of those people and kind of get them to help kind of spread the word of mouth about our organization and what we're doing.
I think this is great advice on social. And, you know, social is really hot this year, as everyone knows. And I think this is just some great practical advice. You sit down on Friday, you take a look at what do we need to tweet about next week, what do we need to blog about next week, and you just kind of wrap it in and just kind of roll it out. We had a similar piece of feedback or piece of sharing from Rachel Spasser last week from Ariba, where she was talking about, you know, pretty much the same thing. So I think this is awesome. And also the fact that for a lot of companies, your blog can or should be the top referral to your website, because people will go to a blog because it comes up in search before they'll go to someone's website. It's just a gentler, softer touch that people seem to find more value in. One other question about the blogs. Do you ever have clients also blog, or is it just internally?
No, we do have guest bloggers quite a bit. So we have partners who come guest blog for us. We also have some third-party thought leaders that come and blog for us sometimes. So we do invite all people to come to us and talk to us about guest blogging. You know, it's something that we open up there. Our blog has been around for quite a while. We've got a great readership and a great subscriber base. So it's something that's out there on Google, and we get a lot of traction on, actually.
Okay, excellent. And, again, just great practical advice for the marketers who are looking for how to incorporate social and also why social is so important to incorporate. But we have about 15 minutes left, and one of the things I definitely want to talk about is, first of all, I had to remind myself several times during the interview that I was talking to marketing, not to sales, and I just find that quite delightful. Because, again, I think this is a hallmark of a revenue marketer. If you're at the stage where you are producing sustainable, predictable, and repeatable revenue, you sound like Evan Whitenight. So I love listening to you talk. And, Evan, I also love your energy. But the other area that I did want to spend a few minutes on was let's talk about data. And, again, you know, there's a number of things that when a marketer begins to use marketing automation and they kind of go through that transition from, you know, early demand generation to late-stage revenue marketing, and I think kind of the way you guys went through the phases is, unfortunately, you know, pretty typical for people. But I do want to talk about the role of data. And one of the things that we're hearing a lot about is the cost of dirty data. So you've got these campaigns. You're reaching out and touching. So can you tell me more about how data is the fuel for a good marketing automation program?
Yeah, sure. I'll start by saying, you know, sharing some great stats that I've seen just from the nature of the business and really taking a look at what I've been doing. But I've seen some stats that show that up to 70% of CRM implementations fail due to dirty data. Up to 50% of marketing automation implementations stutter or aren't as successful as they need to be due to dirty data and the lack of cleanliness with the data. You know, Serious Decisions, again, has a great white paper on the cost of bad data on demand creation. And they have great hard-nosed numbers that actually show marketers with a high data quality practice actually can recognize 70% higher revenue recognition just on data practices alone.
Wow. So, I'm going to tell you something. If anybody's not paying attention to those numbers, then they need to be out of marketing. Those are stunning numbers. So they can get these kind of metrics from Serious Decisions. What about the metric 50% stutter or less than successful because of bad data? Is that a metric from Serious Decisions, or was that one from somebody else?
One of them, I believe, was from Sales and Marketing Institute. I'll have to hunt down the other one.
Okay.
I've got them in some slides that I've done and some presentations, and I can definitely send them over to you to share on the blog with your readership.
That'd be great. I'd love to get that. Okay.
Yeah, but then, like you said, for us, all of our metrics really depend on data being clean. So without the data being clean and accurate and complete and standardized, there's just no way we could execute the level of marketing campaign and the segmented marketing campaigns that we do. So, you know, it goes from A to Z, and I guess I'll start with Z as far as marketing data, because it's kind of a strange place to start, but it's also, for me, kind of the most logical place to start. You always want to take a look at closed won loss analysis and really understand from your business before you engage on anything else where you're winning and where you're losing. And you need to know these things of where your sweet spots are and where you're kind of wasting effort or running into something that's not a fit for your organization. And I truly believe the only way you can really do that is if you have accurate, clean data so that you can really look at from the end point of what you've won and what you've lost based on what industry they're in, what the size of the organization they're in, via employees, via revenue if it's reported. So you can really start to put together and paint a picture of who your most likely and potential customer can be so that you're knocking down kind of the low-hanging fruit rather than really trying to spend cycles and really extending your sales cycle and your revenue cycle. So with that information being said, then we use that information to kind of really lay that as a map going forward in the beginning of the marketing process. So we take all of our data, run it through our standardization and cleanse process, make sure it's fully appended, and then we can chop it up and, like I said, use that data for lead scoring campaigns, use that data for segmented lists as far as SmartList and Marketo. We can really go in from a granular level and really carve our lists up. And another thing that we do that's kind of cool with our own kind of technology that's, again, like eating our own dog food, is we can go in and run algorithms against, with our engine, run algorithms against title in our database, and then we can chop people up based upon their functional role or area. So if they're in marketing, if they're in sales, finance, and then we can also chop them up as far as what their kind of organizational hierarchy is. Are they kind of the C-suite? Are they middle management? Or are they part of the staff of the organization? And then it allows us to really customize our messages based on a matrix that we can lay out of kind of our sweet spots and make sure that all of our messages are very micro-targeted to those specific individuals so that we can help drive our open and click-through rates.
I think that makes so much sense. So I just want to kind of go back through some of the key elements that you've described here for those folks that are listening. So, you know, first of all, the metrics around the cost of dirty data, it's stunning. It's just absolutely stunning. And so a great place to start is not with A, but with Z. Take a look at your closed loss analysis to see what is really the best fit for the organization. This is from our demographic or our firmographic data. And then once you've figured that out, then your whole data cleansing machine and data appending machine, which leads right into lead scoring, is really around that best fit. That's not addressing their propensity to buy, but just are they the sweet spot kind of company for us to work for. And then once you've got that in place, then this gives you the ability to do much, much better segmentation. And one of the things that I heard recently, you know, we're doing this tour with Marketo. It's called the Marketo Revenue Rockstar Roadshow. And what it's all about is how marketers get to revenue. And Jim Linscold is one of the speakers on the tour. He wrote a book called Marketing ROI. And when he takes a look at basically low-hanging fruit, he says your ability to segment is the very first thing that you can do to increase ROI, just that one thing alone. But, again, you can't segment if you haven't backed this thing all the way back up to good data. So I think that's a really, really good map. So once you have the clean data, what other kind of big impacts does that make in your demand generation practice, Evan?
I mean, for us, it really increases a multitude of different things. So with clean data, starting with clean data, it allows us to segment like we talked about. It allows us to accurately lead score like we talked about. It also increases our email sender score. This is a big hiccup that a lot of people see and really run into, I think, when they first transition over to a marketing automation platform, is they're used to buying low-cost, low-quality data through a multitude of different vendors, and then they run that through their marketing automation system, and they're unsuccessful because their bounce rates are high. It affects their email sender score. They then get notifications from their marketing automation or their email kind of blast tools that, hey, where are you getting these lists from? They're triggering spam all over the place. Your sender scores are very low. It also affects your reputation. You know, if you're sending email out that's falling on deaf ears or going into kind of spam honeypots or not the right information that you need to be or actually not the right prospects that you should be sending to, it really affects your organization's reputation on your ability to segment and also get the word out. And marketing is kind of that first line of the company anyway. It's always that first handshake or extension, and you've always got to try to put your best foot forward. From there, you know, dirty data really just flows down the pipeline and really mucks stuff up, and it can really impact not only your marketing activities and trying to drive revenue through there, but it really also increases your cost of sale because, as I said before, you know, if you flip a lead over and it doesn't have the correct phone number and the salesperson has to research that, that's just more and more time that your sales organization, which are high-paid resources, are having to do in order to make that connect, make that qualification.
I could not agree more. I mean, I just think all those things are just absolutely positively true. And, again, what I find so fascinating about this year, whether we're talking about social or whether we're talking about data or whether we're talking about sales and marketing alignment, what we're seeing is that marketing are building real practices, right? It's not just just something else that they do in addition to everything else, but there is this concerted effort and there is this concerted practice that is specific to revenue marketing. So let me ask you the big payoff question. Brand new to marketing automation, marketers looking at this, What are the top three things that you would share with them? What's your lessons learned? What is your top three pieces of advice, Evan?
Yeah, I actually take a lot of these calls as I serve references for a lot of these different organizations. Is number one and the biggest, start small. Don't try to boil the ocean in the beginning. Everything can seem very overwhelming in the beginning, and especially everything that I've talked about from moving things through the funnel, all the serious decisions terminology, the social media stuff that you need to do, all the content that needs to be written. It can become overwhelming and kind of you can get the kind of analysis paralysis mode to where you get this great platform with marketing automation that can really help you drive your business and become more focused on revenue. But I've seen more often than not where a lot of people just get paralyzed and it turns into, you know, a six-month implementation. And I'm sure, Debbie, you've seen where you guys get called in to help resolve this issue.
Because
instead of kicking off one campaign and really showing right off the gate, I'm going to focus on just creating one small, simple campaign that I can get some good revenue, some good metrics that I can share with the rest of the executive team and really show the benefits of the purchase that I just made and really get kind of that gold star next to your name. People decide, well, I've got to put everything in there before I can even do one thing. So that would be my number one tip, and that's kind of what I preach is start small, really get some small successes under your belt, and everything else will kind of snowball and mushroom from there. I'd say kind of the next tip that I could give somebody is, you know, marketing these days is not a 9-to-5 job. It annoys my wife sometimes, but I live, eat, and breathe this stuff. So there's many times in the middle of the night or on the weekends that I'm doing work or I'm reading, you know, or taking training on something or I'm flying out somewhere or I'm doing this or that or the other. And it's something that goes beyond the 9-to-5, I think, if you're going to have a true passion for it and a true understanding and really ramp it going. Now, that being said, I'm not advocating for, you know, a workaholic's lifestyle. I'm just saying it's something that you really have to believe in, be passionate about, and really want to take the initiative on. And I think that really will help with understanding and getting going. And then lastly, it's really the next tip is get that sales buy-in. If you can get sales buy-in, you can get that sales and marketing alignment from the get-go and really define everything and sit down, involve them in everything. marketing shouldn't just be by itself behind closed doors. Involve them in everything. Help plan sales kickoffs. Put together right now we're writing the agenda for our Q2 sales kickoff. I haven't even talked to my VP of sales about it because we're going to sit down and put together an agenda for him, and then I'll sit down and talk to him about it and get his buy-in. But I'm trying to take things off of his plate that we can help do and drive through the organization and really help him focus on end-of-quarter revenue and help us get them off to a quick start for Q2.
I think those are three great lessons learned. Start small. Go with small successes. Remember, it's not 9 to 5. Having belief and passion that this is what you need to be doing as a marketer is important. And number three, getting sales buy-in. Well, Evan, you have been phenomenal. It's always such a pleasure. I learn so much every time I listen to you speak. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, Debbie. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I think it's a great venue to kind of get the word out to other marketers and help educate them.
Absolutely. I hope everyone listens next week as we will be featuring James McGill of QuantaPoint. It's going to be a really interesting session because James does some really interesting things. He's going to talk about how to leverage microsites to improve demand generation results. I hope everyone has a great week, and please continue that journey to revenue marketing. See you guys later. Bye-bye.